What I'd like to do is just look at some of your cartoons or illustrations for a while and see what prompted you to do some of them. There's one that's called Is It Funny? That you did in 1978 that has a lot of these hairy creatures with big snouts, absurd-looking things, wielding big pens. With large pens, not big pens, and they look like they're all snouted cartoonists, and they're asking questions to themselves like, does it address the insanity of contemporary life? Are there subtle truths in the guise of fantasy? Is it exposing our innermost inconsistencies? Does it hold our foibles up to ridicule? And finally, is it funny? I was wondering why, what prompted that, and if that's your criteria, or if that's the stuff that people use when they're analyzing why your stuff is funny.
Well, it's a bit of both. The genesis of it was an exhibition held at Pratt Institute about 3 or 4 years ago for its cartoonist alumni, and among which whom were Pfeiffer and Lee Lorenz, and I was one as well. And they asked us in their preparation of the catalog to make a self-portrait, and I have a chronic dislike of drawing myself and find it very difficult. So what I did was this collage of kind of fatuous critical elements that I suspect people, other people, not certainly not myself, apply to cartoons in a more or less academic way. And the final one, Is It Funny?, which is, of course, what I apply to it, is really the crucial one, but the question of criticism and criticizing our foibles and taking society to task and is a kind of high-blown, rather high-minded approach to what is essentially an extremely unanalyzable activity.
It's amazing how pompous you can sound when you try to explain how comedy functions or how humor functions.
Well, it's impossible, really. It's and certainly for people like myself who do it, it's even worse. Like to be called a noted funny man is
that's good.
is a contradiction, because you know to be noted is one thing, but you can't be funny about it. And as long as you feel a certain position in society, you cannot be funny. So that might explain a bit of that.
Well, I'm going to flip to another illustration, and this is, it's called Leisure Hours on the Pike, and it's like a four-lane highway with hundreds of cars, each car loaded up with creatures with the snouts and the fangs, absurd-looking things. There's a police car and vans and small cars and bigger cars, and some people are looking bored and others are kvetching at one another. And everybody looks really absurd and trapped, and I know that I've been one of these creatures at some time or another, trapped and bitter and annoyed on the highway. And I was thinking, well, first tell, if you can remember, tell, if you could tell me about how you did it, and then I'll tell you about how I react to seeing it.
Well, I did it really with very little point in mind. It turned out finally to be to appear in Esquire, only after the fact. I drew it simply because of my fascination with you know how we humans get trapped in these steel boxes with four rubber feet, or motorcycles, or whatever means of conveyance, which seem for us to be the kind of staple of life, and just how they frame us, both visually and mentally, and what people look like in cars. I mean, I have one of these perverse pleasures in traffic jams. I don't mind being caught in them simply because it gives me a chance to study people on either side of me in that frame of a window that it sort of makes for heads. And
do you catch people picking their nose
off? Oh, constantly. Picking their noses, their ears, kind of looking dazedly off into space, or growling at, you know, whoever happens to be next to them. Or what goes on inside that box, because all sorts of family or things and relationships go on, planned, unplanned, and of all sorts. And it's like almost a metaphor, although I hate to say it. It sounds too high-blown, but it is.
Excuse me, does it hold our foibles up to ridicule?
Right. Well, the traffic jam certainly does, because it compresses all those feelings of rage that people feel being frustrated and impeded. So I've drawn a lot of things like that, a lot of just simply without any publication in mind or any kind of purpose in mind. And it was, as I say, published quite accidentally and fortuitously.
I know that I've been in situations like this traffic jam that you've illustrated, and feeling as absurd as the people who you've illustrated look, but you're trapped, you know. It's like there's so many situations that you're caught in that you realize the absurdity of it, and you know you're a character in this silly landscape, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it.
Well, it's true, and I don't know if you've noticed, but people's expressions of people change in circumstances like that. They're very, you know, character changes. And I mean, as an index, the character, there's a great transformation in circumstances like this, which are not pleasant. They're, you know, most people consider them without pleasure. So it's that too is a kind of area of fascination.
Now here's one of you call it our vital literary life, and this time all the little creatures are obviously members of the literary scene, and some of them are holding books. Some of them are posed around the table. A couple are chatting at the bar. Hmm. Is this your impression of the literary scene in America?
Well, to a certain extent, it's an impression of the fatuous ways in which our poets and writers gather and present themselves. But the immediate function of that drawing was to as an announcement for a friend of mine's publishing party, which was a book about literary New York. In fact, the title of the book was Literary New York, which was a history of the places in which writers lived over the past 200 years. And it was a kind of guide, a guide to their geographical guide to where they lived and how they lived and as much anecdotal material as could be gathered about them. So that announcement that you described spanned a lot of many generations of literateurs.
Is anybody people. Insulted?
No. That's the thing, is that nobody is ever insulted by, as far as I know, by what I do, which is a great pity. I sometimes feel I've failed miserably by people loving what I do. It's kind of a strange sensation to be.
I think it's in part because you play on the absurdities that we know are absurd and feel so helpless about. I mean, just because, you know what I mean? Like we know we're making fools of ourselves half the time. And
well, it's true in certain circumstances, like the traffic jam, but here, I mean, the kind of...
It's true.
Fatuousness of...
Pomposity, yeah. Wait, why don't you try explaining this one here?
Oh, it was another drawing of, again, which was not published except in this anthology, that I did at the, I think, what's the date on it, 1970 or
74.
74, was that? Well, I think it was actually done earlier. It was a time of great unrest, and it was done before. I know, I think that's badly, it's wrongly dated, but at any rate, it was done during the time of unrest in the early 70s, when there was always confrontation between the police and other members of the society, and myself included, and you know, the police really were the enemy, and at least the most visible enemy at the time, and or at least the agents of the enemy, and they were frequently very brutal in dealing with civil unrest. I mean, just needlessly, pointlessly brutal. And I was involved in some situations like that. But somehow, my depiction of this policeman in a police car with his rather hostile, nasty, somewhat suspicious, xenophobic expression, it was just a very natural and easy way for me to express how I was feeling at the time. But it was part of a larger series of drawings that I did on urban unrest and civil unrest. Many drawings of this sort.
What were some of the others?
Well, some of the others were you know, more graphic depictions of what I experienced. You know, police, you know, charging crowds of anti-war demonstrators, for example. Once it occurred in Boston, where some people were demonstrating on the sidewalks in front of a church. A group of solid middle-class people who were mostly older than young demonstrators, or people with babies and baby carriages, and they were just very sincere. I mean, in their expressing their feelings, they weren't doing anything that would provoke the police, other than being there and other than expressing sentiments that the police didn't probably agree with. And they charged us, swinging sticks, knocking people over, knocking people out. Great carnage. And that stuck with me and it still is with me, in fact, as a really traumatic moment. And, so that plus what I knew and of other people's experiences and so on. And it just produced a whole, maybe 100 or so drawings on the subject, of some more graphic than others, more descriptive of what I saw. And, that plus the riots of the ghettos and the earlier on and so on, it's and the carnage there. So but these are drawings that are never published, except this one, which is in this.
Would you have trouble publishing those?
Well, publishing which, this?
The ones about unrest.
Well, I never tried. I mean, they were not cartoons. They were not, they weren't particularly funny.
Uh-huh.
They have the kind of edge that I was talking about earlier, that I would, that people wouldn't necessarily enjoy,
right,
or find benign or cute, which is the other term that curdles my blood, but which is frequently applied to some of these things. But I never did try to publish them, since there was no place to publish them. Occasionally.
What about, I'm not trying to place them for you, but what about some of the, you know, like alternative press type places?
Well, I published things in The Nation recently, but that's because I sort of knew The Nation. I do know The Nation editorial staff, and that's what I do these days. But earlier, I guess I'd, in not knowing, not having access, easy access to the publications, I just never tried. It was in some ways kind of passivity about it. I did them, that sort of expressed, and they were enormous drawings, and they weren't easily published.
Mm-hmm.
Very long, they weren't cartoon size.
Right. Let's get to one other illustration, and let me ask you to describe this one also.
No, it was a fishbowl with an enormous fish. Great fish that takes up almost the entire space of the fishbowl, and he is extremely grumpy about being so confined. And it's again a little bit like people confined in their automobiles. It's the same kind of angry frustration that one encounters when people are impeded in their in what they want to do. But somehow that it's a very, it's a small irony in a way that drawing is it's a small drawing.
The fish has teeth also,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, what's interesting to me is the ferocity of this creature who is confined. I mean, he simply can't move anywhere. And somehow putting that drawing next to the police drawing of the policeman, you could probably draw the inference that it's, you know, this is what happens. This is the other side of the legal system, although it was laid out not by me. I mean, the editor of the book did that.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with cartoonist and illustrator Ed Koren. And by the way, the book that we've been paging through is called Man Bites Man, Two Decades of Satiric Art. It's a book edited by Stephen Heller that has the work of a number of different cartoonists. Do you think that middle-class people are any more absurd than any other people are?
Well, there are several ways of answering it. For one thing, they're the people I know best, being one of them. And I mean, they're my people, and my tribe, and so therefore I'm really much more adept and capable of seeing those nuances of ridiculousness and in fact, because I draw for the New Yorker, whose readership is entirely, as far as I can tell, of the middle class, that. Somehow it's all of a piece. There's a certain kind of elitism. The middle class knows how to read these because it's really reading about themselves. I think another culture or another segment of American society wouldn't know what to make of it. some of the cartoons in the New Yorker. It would be not their world at all. And so that, in a way, the middle class is, for me, a kind of open book. And also because, in some ways, because of the presumption in middle class life, or the presumptions of stability and economic well-being and kind of faith in future, the development of a personal future, and because of the ways in which we have all, kind of verbally developed these things. Like I was telling you before about this young man on a radio station, college radio station, who late one night complained rather bitterly. I wouldn't say bitterly. No, he just simply complained in a kind of sorry way that he said, I've been working on myself so much, I haven't had time for my schoolwork. Now, that is a middle class statement. I mean, it could be, but it probably wouldn't necessarily be said by anybody else. The notion of working on yourself, of narcissistic kind of self-involvement, these are all sort of part and parcel of what's happening and what has happened recently in American life, and it's something that just fascinates me endlessly.
Do you do a lot of eavesdropping too?
Always, yeah. Always. I mean, in some ways, people have asked me if I ever run out of ideas or where I get my ideas, and it's one of the most frequent kind of queries I get, and the answer is simply in your ears and eyes. I'm never let down, and I'm always surprised by what I overhear.
What are some of the better, more fertile places for this form of eavesdropping?
Almost anywhere. I mean, even on if you pass people on the street who you glean snatches of conversation that somehow fall into place, or in restaurants, or trains, or almost any public space, in movie theaters, or in the theaters. The other day, I took my daughter to a play, and behind us were two women, and one of them said, "I just got the Bonwitz catalog, and I must say, I'm not impressed." So, and it's constant. And I have books full of these things.
You don't write them down as it's happening, do you?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
This is my nightmare, that I'm going to say something that I'm a little unsure of, and someone's going to whip out a pen and say, "Wow, how stupid," and they'll be copying it down and committing it to history in one way or another.
Well, I promise I won't do it.
Right, thank you. Trains are probably pretty good for that?
Well, any means of public conveyance are good. Any place where people gather. I mean, that's one of the reasons why automobile travel is so sterile. There's just no way of contacting any, or hearing, or observing other people. Except through your own window.
A lot of people buy the New Yorker strictly for the cartoons, I think, and don't even bother reading the articles, or maybe read the Pauline Kael film review, and that's about it. Is there anything, do you think, that holds together the stable of New York cartoonists?
Probably nothing more than what we were talking about earlier, the middle class quality of life that they and I all work with in one way or another, and be it fantasy of more fantastic sorts of things that, say, George Booth does. I mean, Booth's people, for example, are not middle-class people in the least, nor necessarily are George Price's, but still they require a middle-class audience to read them, to understand them, and to peruse them.
So any written or unwritten code about what kind of subject matter or what kind of language you can use, or who you can poke fun at, how political it can be?
Well, I would say that's not so much a code as just an understanding, in a sense, that the editors will not take or even entertain things about, harsh things about religion, harshly political statements, kind of things that will make fun of really bitterly and angrily make fun of the less favored members of the society, the old, the lame, infirm, which is, you know, so it does impose a certain kind of code, but it really has never been stated. And the only way you could ever come to know it is simply by doing cartoons on that subject and those subjects and having them rejected. But there would, no one has ever said, to me at least, you know, this is not a subject that we will deal with or won't deal with. It's really kind of trial and error that's come out. And it's also, for me, it's there are things I wouldn't make fun of anyhow. I mean, I wouldn't go to bitterly racial cartoons. I mean, I don't think that way, or chauvinist things, or you know, the kind of things that would appear in Playboy, say, would never appear in the New Yorker, simply because I think a lot of cartoonists don't think that way, and certainly the editors wouldn't want it there as an extreme example.
It seems to me that different generations of cartoonists deal with sex differently.
Yeah, and especially in the New Yorker, there isn't much sex,
uh-huh.
as you have.
No, absolutely. But I mean, you mentioned Playboy. And
yeah, yeah. But those cartoons are extremely unpleasant as an attitude towards sex. I mean, there's no joy in them. There's just a lot of, you know, kind of bitter raunchiness. And kind of anger about it too. That's right on the surface. I personally find extremely unsavory.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
And I've always been, I guess, somewhat surprised about that, since the magazine is supposed to be. I mean, you know that it's not reaching this audience.
I know.
It's supposed to be this great, like, liberated, sexually liberated, mm-hmm, freeing, mm-hmm, kind of thing. And as you said, it has a terribly, really neurotic attitude about
it. Yeah, it's cruel. Cruel, mm-hmm, in effect. And that's certainly not the point.
Talking with Ed Koren, if you're just joining us, the cartoonist and illustrator. His work is in The Nation now.
Occasionally. Once every few months, I'll do something for them.
And The New Yorker. Is there such a thing as a better or worse spot in The New Yorker to have your cartoon?
I think, it's all unplanned. It's all quite random, for one thing, about where they are placed and how big they are and when they appear. Because the drawings are printed usually according to size and where they will fit in terms of the text. And I don't think there's any conscious effort to place cartoons to certain texts, for example, or in the front or the back. I mean, if I do a cartoon that will reduce in size, I usually draw quite large, many times the size of when they appear. And so when they're reduced to the printable size, they sometimes are small and sometimes are large. And the smaller ones frequently appear in the back of the simply because of their dimensions.
Do you remember the first cartoons you did in the style that we've been discussing with the snouted creatures?
Oh, not really. No, because they evolved to a degree that is hard for me to place in time. I mean, it's been a long and slow and kind of gradual evolution. And I only understand them, how they've evolved, when I look back on them, when I get them all together, and as I did yesterday, just to make some slide presentation, and they were all there, and I saw that they had changed over the years. I know they have, but it always strikes me anew and afresh that they have. But when, I don't know. It came sometime in the last 6 or 7 years, I think.
You went to college, I'm not sure where, Columbia?
Yeah, I went to Columbia.
Were you an art department or
no,
an English
no,
department?
No, not at all, not at all. I was just one of your millions of liberal arts graduates with no particular craft or special interest, but a kind of very broad curiosity about most of anything and a expertise in very little.
Was it difficult to become a professional cartoonist without having that or art school credential?
Well, I don't think there's a correlation between the two, because it's very hard to teach anyone how to be a cartoonist. There's no way of teaching it. And I, for example, I taught for some years at Brown University, and I taught art, but I taught strictly conventional drawing and printmaking and foundation courses that had nothing to do with cartoons. And I would frequently be asked by students to whether I would teach cartooning, make a special course, and I wouldn't, because there's no way of endowing anyone with a peculiar style, which is the way it should be, that is peculiar, and nor can you teach anyone to perceive things in the ways that would be germane to a cartoonist. I mean, for example, you can't teach somebody to be angry, or moralistic, or righteous, or amused, or whatever other combination of personal qualities, you know, a cartoonist or some cartoonists have. You know, just no way of doing that. So, and besides which, in terms of drawing, it's really quite impossible to develop a style which is so personal and such a signature that by the virtue of teaching it, you're, you know, demolishing the very thing you want to establish.
Well, what are the advantages of having a really recognizable style?
Well, that's hard to answer, because it's such a signature. It's something you don't work at or towards. It simply grows and develops, as I said before about how these drawings of mine develop. The virtue is simply that if there's any, it affords you a very succinct way of expressing some ideas, but somehow the style and the ideas, that is the way of drawing, and the ideas are inseparable. So you can't really sort them out.
You illustrated the book that was written by Delia Ephron,
yeah,
called How to Eat Like a Child, which has become a bestseller and I think has been very successful both for adults,
mm-hmm,
and for children. I'm not sure who it was initially targeted for. I think adults.
Well, it was for adults as a kind of nostalgic view back towards childhood. But in fact, what happened was that it became extremely popular with kids, enormously popular with kids, and from young ages, about 6 or 7 on up, to the great surprise of Delia Ephron and myself. And there's another book now called Teenage Romance, which she wrote and I illustrated, which has just come out, which is a next step from up from How to Eat Like a Child. And it's called Teenage Romance or How to Die of Embarrassment, which is a very funny, again, evocation of what it's like for, that is, evocation for older people, for what it's like to be a teenager. However, it turns out that teenagers now just are very fond of it, find it very funny.
You know, a lot of people think that if you're trying to do something that children will think is funny, that you have to think completely differently, a completely different framework than you would for what you think is funny or what you think other adults will find funny. Did this convince you that you don't need to do that?
Yeah, it was something I knew before in a way, but I was convinced by it now. I mean, there's no reason to condescend or to change anything towards kids, because they will. First of all, I wouldn't know how to change a drawing for a child if I were to be given that assignment. But I think in writing for kids too, it must be exactly the same. And that is a book of that sort. I'm not talking about anything.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Did you remember the stuff that made you laugh a lot when you were young, and the stuff that adults thought you'd find really funny but you really didn't like?
I remember the first more than the latter. I mean, you mentioned Bob and Ray, and Bob and Ray was for me a staple of my young years. I mean, I was fascinated by them, and would listen avidly to this New York radio station, I was trying to think of which one it was. But at any rate, it was a radio station in the early 50s, early middle 50s, because they bounced around from station to station. And then, of course, the Bert and Harry Peel commercials, which were great entertainment at the time. They were wonderful. They were on the radio before I think they went to television. So that and some, of course, a lot of comic strips that I read when I was a kid.
Which ones?
Oh, there was. The one in particular impression was Jimmy Hatlow's. They'll Do It Every Time. It was a panel cartoon divided into two, and he relied on his readers sending in suggestions, such as, you know, your aunt's Sadie stepping out of the car into a puddle, or some such, you know, mundane domestic tragedy. And I was an avid daily reader of that. And plus, you know, the usual sort of Mutton Jeff and Alley Oop,
yeah.
And what's George McManus?
Nancy? No.
Well, Nancy too, but
the one Nancy I really remember from my childhood is one where she's dreaming, and at the end of the dream, credits roll, in which she's the executive director and the producer and the screenwriter. Oh, well. Are there times that you felt like you were selling out or doing stuff that wasn't really in your style or stuff that would really excite you, but you did it for your living?
Yeah, well, I've done some advertising, which has struck me that way. And it's not the question of the style, because that didn't change in any way, but it was the goal, the end. The reason for doing it that has given me a lot of pause and a certain amount of anxiety, but for you know, reasons that a lot of people do a lot of work that they don't want to do. But I have been told that it doesn't make any difference. That is, you know, the drawings are funny in and of themselves, and if no matter what context they're in, and sometimes. But I don't really believe that. I think. I do feel strange sometimes having work appear as in advertising for the benefits of somebody else.
Do you do the same kind of figures for the advertisement?
Yeah, there's no change in what I do. And in some ways, that's why advertisers want to use the things I do. I've done a fair amount of advertising, in fact, lately. And it still is. Sometimes if it's a challenge and it isn't offensive to me, I will rather enjoy it, but on the other hand, if it's offensive, I won't do it. So, but it's offensive is not the word, but you know, there are times I just don't take any great pleasure in it, which I do in most other cases.
I'm not sure if I've seen any of your ads, but I know I've seen like office machine
Xerox
companies,
Xerox,
yeah, using reprints from the New Yorker.
Yeah,
I guess they know who their potential buyers are and what publications they read.
Well, I don't think they've reprinted from the New Yorker so much.
I think I remember seeing, you know, C circled New Yorker down the side. Maybe not.
No, because
they wouldn't let
the New Yorker wouldn't
allow
it. Yeah. No, I think it's probably been undoubtedly with drawings I did for the company.
See how strongly certain images are.
Yeah.
You know, you just imagine you're seeing it, even if you're not. I'm always curious to see what people say to this. Do you ever feel like you really need to take a break from the kind of work that you're doing? And if you feel like you're getting close to burnout,
mm-hmm.
what do you do?
Well, a lot of different things. I'll sort of go and take a bicycle trip somewhere, or come go to another city and go to the museums, or simply go to New York and go to galleries and museums, or wander the streets, or just amuse myself. But usually sometimes going to look at the art of others, especially old master art that I tend to love, revives that kind of burnt out, just kind of fills up the reservoir again. And also just wandering the streets of New York is, or even now Philadelphia, it's just very...
No, watch out.
No, it's been quite pleasant, just you know, promenading around the streets here.
Do we Philadelphians say absurd things differently than New Yorkers
no,
do?
No.
Same old stuff?
Yeah.
Did you ever look at old New Yorkers from 20 years ago or... more?
Well, 20 years ago was my years when I was looking at it when I was growing up. But sure.
Longer than that. Do the things that are satirized look a lot different?
To a degree. I mean, life was more, you know, what was satirized was more proper to some extent. I mean, Helen Hokanson's Ladies, for example, were far more rigidly structured in their mores than now. I mean, you don't find that kind of that subject matter so much. I mean, if you start looking at the New Yorker and see what the New Yorker, for example, which is the most, I think of it as a kind of sociology of sorts of the middle class, and you know, there are a lot of parties, a lot of business situations of people at desks. What else? Cats and dogs, of course. But you know, it's if you look at it aside from the personalities of some of the cartoonists, there is a considerable change in that it is seems to be less formal, a society that's being so satirized. But I think it again depends on the cartoonist, because George Price, his crazy, mad people certainly were never formal, but Peter Arnold's were, and Charles Adams has his own world, which I think surmounts any identifiable one. So there's, you know, the fantasy involved kind of makes it hard to generalize about how you can read social change through the pages of the New Yorker.
Yeah.
You probably can read it better in the ads and how they've changed.
It's still fur coats, isn't it?
Still fur coats, but I think the copy, not the object so much as just
how they woo you.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time, but there's one last thing I want to know. When you buy or when you get for free, whichever way you get it, the New Yorker, do you just read the cartoons or do you read the articles also?
I read everything.
Do you?
No, I do.
Okay.
I do. I'm fascinated by a lot of the articles. Not all, certainly, but some of them.
Great. Ed Koren, I've really enjoyed talking to you. I'm really glad you were able to visit with us.
My great pleasure, too.